I walked up with these this morning, and Damon said, Mary Ellen, you don't have time to read all that today. What a drag. I'm Mary Ellen, and I'm an alcoholic. Good morning. Gosh, you guys, this is such an honor. I know, like, you know, you watch those shows on TV, and people are like, gosh, it's such an honor. Honored to be nominated, whatever. But no, it really is, and this is a huge honor. When Johnny asked me to tell my story, it both frightened and excited me. So digging back through all that stuff and telling my story from what I used to be like, what I went through and what I'm like now, is it's been a journey, but it's been a really good journey, and I'm happy, joyous, and free today because of that journey. So basically, I'm going to give you first a spoiler alert. For those of you who don't know me well, probably will be some crying. Is there a Kleenex around? No? Oh, here we go. Good. Okay. Pretty good supply. Yeah, we're good. And it may involve ugly crying. So just heads up, you know, I'm not one of those girls that just gets like the little tear and looks really, you know, it's yeah. Anyway, just want to give you that spoiler alert. In case you want to leave now, we'll give you a couple minutes. Anybody? So basically, I was born, we don't need to talk about years, long time ago, to a wonderful family. I really can't point to childhood as any kind of big red flag for my future career as an alcoholic. I had a fantastic childhood. I would go as far as to say, to quote one of my friends, that I grew up in a Norman Rockwell painting. I mean, truly, I was the youngest of four children, born to two wonderful parents. My father was a Depression-era child, born in 1921, lived through the Great Depression, and he was a, I don't know if y'all remember, who in here remembers Dan Fogelberg? I would describe my dad from that Run for the Roses song as the leader of the band, as the man with the thundering velvet hand. He was a disciplinarian, but he was also extremely loving. He just wanted you to do the right thing. You know, consequences for bad behavior, owning up to your mistakes. He had favorite expressions like, can't never did anything. I can't do that, Dad. Can't never did anything. You know, just, I'll give you something to cry about was one of his favorites. And my personal favorite was, as a young girl, seeing my dad working on the car. And he'd be out there, and there's, you know, probably some blue words flying here and there. And I would go by, you know, happy-go-lucky, just playing with my friends. Hey, Dad, what are you doing? You know, pretty obvious what he's doing, right? The hood of the car is up. He's buried in the car. And he turned around to me and said, making a pair of pants for a fish. And I walked away like, why would a fish need a pair of pants? You know, so. But very loving mother, stayed at home. My father was an aeronautical engineer, very good job. I never wanted for anything. I never had, like, you know, I don't have any terrible childhood tale to tell, really. I did have some of those moments with brothers, with three brothers, you know, finding my dolls hanging up in closets with blindfolds on and things like that. But I don't think that contributed to my drinking. I don't think. But I wouldn't say that I really had alcohol in the home either. My father did not drink at all, I think because his father drank. So there's that little genetic connection on that side of the family. And my mother, I don't remember my mother drinking in front of me until I think when I was like maybe late elementary school, and she had a heart attack, and she was drinking like a little glass of sherry while she made dinner. But I never saw my parents drunk, obviously, because my dad didn't drink. I never saw my mom drunk except for one time. It's kind of funny. My parents were out at a party, and they came in, and my mom got carried in. And that was just, you know, that kind of stuff didn't happen in my house, you know. And I remember asking my dad, who was obviously not a drinker, so I'm sure he was not amused, what's wrong with mommy? She's a little bit sick. She'll be fine, you know. So that's the only memory I really have of my mom as a child drinking too much. But my introduction to alcohol was probably like early high school. I had a great, great bunch of friends, very involved in high school. Always remember wanting to be that kid, being the youngest of four and having three older brothers. There's a big age gap. My oldest brother is, like, at now present time, my oldest brother is 73 and I'm 58. So we have a 15-year difference. And then the second oldest brother is 10 years older than me. And then the one that's closest in age to me is 21 months older. So we almost had two families. So by the time I was 6 years old, my oldest brother was married to a woman that my parents really didn't care for. But within a few years, my oldest brother got married and divorced. My second oldest brother got a girl pregnant, married and divorced. And I think the only tie I can think of as being a pressure point for me was I wanted to be that good kid. I wanted to have my parents be proud of me. I didn't want to be them to. I hated when my. I would rather my parents stab me than say, "Mary Ellen, I am so disappointed in you." I hated that. Oh my God, I did. That was enough for me to straighten up. You know, I'm so disappointed in you. That just really. I didn't want to disappoint them. So I think the control part for me, maybe my control tendencies started that young, wanting to be the perfect kid, and you know, not give my parents something to cry about because I'd seen way too much of that already in my young life with my brothers. So high school was what I thought was normal, I hope so. Pretty early, I want to say like, you know, 14, 15 years old, people sneaking, you know, the drink of choice back then was like, you know, really hardcore stuff like Boone's Farm. Maybe some TJ Swan Easy Nights, you know, really, really hardcore stuff. But that's the kind of stuff that we drank, and I remember liking the effect more than the taste early on. Like, I didn't like the taste, but I was like, oh, this is really kind of fun, you know. So I liked the effect. It was never like, oh, I don't like the way it makes me feel. No, I really liked the way it made me feel. So we would, I lived in Missouri, grew up in St. Louis, and so at that time the drinking age was 21 in Missouri and 18 in Illinois. So we were right across the bridge, you know. So that was not uncommon for kids in my high school to, you know, drive over to Illinois, pick up booze and drive it back. Sure, all legal, you know, I'm sure there was no problem there. But if you had a fake ID, and I was always tall, so if you had a fake ID and could reach the bar, you were pretty good, you know, you're pretty golden. So high school parties, you know, nothing too harmful, just, you know, the usual stuff, drinking, having fun. And college was kind of the next uptick where I feel like the drinking escalated. None of it seemed abnormal at the time. You know, just everybody drank, everybody went to parties, but college was suddenly freedom, you know. No mom and dad to have to not disappoint anymore. Me and my friends, and we could, gosh, so-and-so's having a party on Wednesday. Wednesday? Wednesday drinking? All right. I can do that. So there was always opportunity. No matter what day of the week it was, there was always opportunity. And, of course, everybody had cars. And I didn't have a car, but I always had a lot of friends that had cars. So it was just, I guess it was the availability of it really increased. And this is another point I remember is going to 25-cent draw parties. So that tells you how old I am. Yeah, 25-cent beer. So, you know, a good-sized cup of beer for 25 cents. And I was like, don't like beer. But hey, I could learn to like beer. If I can get a good buzz for a couple bucks, I'm there, you know. So I learned to like beer. I mean, that's how screwed up is that? I didn't think it was screwed up at the time, but now I kind of recognize that. Maybe a little red flag. So I remember vividly in my freshman year of college, there was a girl on my dorm floor that caught wind of the fact that I had never been puking drunk. And it really, I think it bothered her more than it did me. I was like, no, I've never thrown up drunk. You've never been puking drunk? Her name was Letty Welch. I'll never forget her name. And so, you know, Letty proceeded to make it her mission to get me puking drunk, and she did. She, good job, Letty. I wonder sometimes if Letty's not in a room somewhere today telling her story. Could be. So I met my husband after graduation. I graduated in 1982 from college, and small world story, Jim in here. I went to school with Jim. We didn't know each other, but I'm sure we partied at the same parties. I graduated in 82 and met my husband in 1985. He was an aeronautical engineer working for McDonnell Douglas Aircraft, and my father, of course, had worked for them for 30 years. And we met, and it was just so weird. We met in a bar. Go figure. But we got married in 1986. We saved for a house for like a whole year. I remember that year vividly because we wanted to put enough money down on the house that we didn't pay the PMI, the mortgage insurance. So we did nothing for a year except for just save. And we partied with friends who were kind of like-minded. They were looking for houses and trying to save money. So we would just get together and play games and drink. And we drank pretty hardy. We had good hard party and friends. So again, I think the environment never seemed unusual to me. Everybody around me was drinking. We all had fun. So there, that was the time in my life when it was still fun. I enjoyed it. I'm sure I had some good hangovers, but I enjoyed everything. Nothing really seemed out of the ordinary. So I remember we kind of went through a period for about 2 years of infertility. We were trying to have our first child, wasn't happening, and that was kind of another brush with the control thing, you know, where my whole life, if I wanted something, if I worked hard enough, saved hard enough, tried hard enough, I got it. And here came this thing. Okay, I'm ready to have children now. And it wasn't happening. And there was no way I could control that. And that was difficult. That was really a painful time, because I knew it was something that Ron and I couldn't control. And it was just hard. And finally, I wanted to be a mom since the time I was a little girl playing with Barbie dolls and baby dolls. I mean, I knew there was never a question that I was going to be a mom someday. That was like something I knew I wanted to do. So finally we got pregnant with our daughter Kelsey, and she was born in 1991. I didn't ever drink during pregnancy. Heck, I didn't even have coffee during pregnancy, so that tells you a lot. I mean, I am never without my coffee. So had the baby, and I can remember the first time we went out, I was looking forward to having a cocktail. I mean, I was really looking forward to it. So we went out with some friends and had margaritas. And I remember I had, you know, I'm sure not drinking for 9 months or whatever. It was, didn't probably take a whole lot, but I remember waking up with a rip-roaring hangover. And our daughter did not work with us well that night. She woke up, I don't know how many times during the night. So I just remember that vividly, that whole, this sounds like a great idea. And then the baby crying, getting a whole nother level of suckiness to a hangover. So in 1994, our son Clark came along, and we kind of decided then that he was kind of a difficult baby. He was, wow, that kid did not sleep. It was like we were starting to wonder if he would ever sleep. I mean, it was like people say, oh, my baby's sleeping tonight at 6 weeks. I'm like, bitch. I'm like, that's, and I still tell people, say, oh yeah, my son slept through it, you know, at 6 months. I'm like, that's nice. Mine was 2 years old by the time he finally slept through the night. So that was how he started out. But then after he got through that rough spot, he was just an amazing kid. So our little family was kind of complete. Like, once I did the math and realized I'd be 40 years old with a kindergartner, it's like, yeah, we're good. So we took care of that. Ron stepped up and got the vasectomy, so we were all set. So, raising kids was a typical, you know, the blur of raising kids and activities and sleepless nights and, you know, people sick and all that stuff. Just kind of, we joke about it now how it's just this blur. We're like, do you remember the kids being little? Yeah, sort of. I mean, there's highs and lows and peaks and valleys I remember, but it was a blur. So, I can remember that feeling of just kind of thinking it might be nice to remember a little more of it than I do now. But I don't think the remembering part is due to alcohol. I think it's just that it was no sleep for so many years. But during that time when the kids were growing up, I think I kind of got into a habit, maybe it's my mom, of having a glass of wine while I cooked dinner. And that seemed like a really good idea. And then, you know, so my weekend, just weekend drinking turned into, oh, well, you know, why not have a glass of wine? So then the glass of wine kind of became another glass of wine. And it just kind of, so it wasn't like this, you know, downhill spiral. It was a very gradual thing. I just, more and more during the week became fine. We used to be weekend drinkers, and it became where it was kind of like whenever you felt like it. Not all day or anything, but it was definitely every night. Every evening I was having a glass of wine and liking it, of course. So daughter and son graduated college and high school the same year, respectively. Our daughter went on to work, and our son went off to Georgia Tech. And, like, a lot of people really get excited about that time in their life. You know, like, oh, empty nest. Hell yeah. And I'm like, empty nest? What an empty nest. And I really didn't and still don't. I love having my kids around. I just do. I love them, and maybe even more so as adults now. I just love being with them. They're awesome, and I love spending time with them. So Clark went off to school, and Kelsey was working, and Clark was in school about a year, and pretty much the unthinkable happened. We had a, this is where the ugly crying starts. Our son was sleeping one night and fell out of a lofted bed at Georgia Tech. He was just sound asleep, rolled out 7 feet, landed on his head. And that led to the worst time of our lives, pretty much. So to say that during that time, coma, 2.5 months, blood clots, infections, not knowing if he'd come back, basically. We were told at one point during brain surgery he might not make it. And it was the worst. I haven't found a word yet. I've told some of you all this. People say, gosh, that must have been horrible. I'm like, no, it was way worse than horrible. There isn't a word that I can really ascribe to it that really tells you how horrible it was. The only thing that would have been worse was losing him. And we thank God did not lose him. He has come a long way, and he's crawled through all that therapy and learned how to walk and talk and swallow and everything all over again, and it took about almost 2 years. But he's a miracle. He's a truly a walking, talking miracle. He is back at Georgia Tech studying mechanical engineering and set to graduate next year. So God is good. So during that time, to say that alcohol became an anesthetic for me, that's exactly what it became. My drinking really took off. It was a way to come home and just wash away. I heard some guy last night share in a meeting that if there was a big problem in his life, he just poured alcohol all over it. Well, I marinated my life back then in alcohol because it was the only way I could get through it. It was just too painful. And whenever I hear people's stories, I think that's what's behind a lot of drinking is great pain. And we almost feel justified in it. Like I know that I have friends say, oh, well, of course you were drinking too much. You were in pain. I mean, it was, oh, well, anybody would drink. Yeah, but, you know, that doesn't mean that it's good. I mean, it wasn't good. It was hard on me, hard on my body, hard on my marriage. And, Ron, thank God, I mean, in the beginning when he knew I had a problem long before I did, of course, and he just kind of kept after me. And in the beginning, I was just like, God, leave me alone. I'm fine. Oh, well, I'm not drinking. That's great. Good for you. You know, I didn't want to hear it. I didn't want to know about it. I just wanted to do what I was doing. I'm fine. I'm moving forward. I'm getting Clark to therapy. I'm doing what I need to do. And that urging, gentle and not so gentle sometimes, is what really made me finally look at myself. And Ron kept steering me toward this test. You should take that online test. And I'm like, oh, that sounds wonderful. I love tests, you know. Spoken by the engineer, right? So I finally, after having it suggested to me, you know, many, many times, I finally went, I'm like, I'm going to go take that stupid test. I'm going to prove to him that I'm not an alcoholic. So I go online and I take the test. So here's the questions. And the questions, to be honest and in all fairness to me, I think the reason I did so well on this test, I think the questions were tricky. Wasn't what I was expecting. I think I was caught off guard. Anyway, okay. So number one, have you ever decided to stop drinking for a week or so but only lasted for a couple of days? Check. Yep. Okay, that's just the first question, though. I'm sure the other ones will be better. I mean, it's not a big deal. Do you wish people would mind their own business about your drinking? Stop telling you what to do? Yeah. Have you ever switched from one kind of drink to another in the hope that this would keep you from getting drunk? 3 for 3. Have you had to have an eye-opener upon awakening during the past year? No. Oh, God. Thank God, I did not. I haven't done that one. Not, as Damon would say, not yet. Do you envy people who can drink without getting into trouble? Yeah, I have to check that one twice probably. Okay. Have you had problems connected with drinking during the past year? Maybe my husband might be thinking about divorcing me. Yeah, that's probably a problem. Okay. Has your drinking caused trouble at home? Well, you just asked me that. That one wasn't fair. That was right on the tail of six where they asked me if I had problems drinking. And then, I mean, I think that was a little bit unfair. Anyway, do you ever try to get extra drinks at the party because you do not get enough? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Always had a backup plan. Always. Little wine bottles in the purse, whatever it takes. Got to do it. Do you tell yourself that you can stop drinking anytime you want to, even though you keep getting drunk when you don't mean to? Oh, yeah. Okay. Have you missed days of work or school because of drinking? Now, I, in the beginning, checked X to this. No, I haven't lost any. No, that hasn't happened to me. But as the, in full disclosure, I'm self-employed, so makes it a little easier on the when the boss is yourself. Do you have blackouts? Another one that I put an X to, because I don't think I really had an understanding of what blackout was. And I understand now what blackout is when you drink to the point that you fall asleep or you just pass out or you do things you don't remember the next day. And I had this more of a, I don't know what, it's almost like me not believing I was an alcoholic because I wasn't on the park bench with the brown bottle. I had like this, you know, very limited idea of what a blackout was. But yes, if I had to go back now, I would have to check yes to that one. Have you ever felt that your life would be better if you did not drink? Yeah. Yeah, it really would be. So, to be honest, you know, I got like 9 out of 12. So, depending on how you grade the test, I either did really well or really poorly. So, but I was glad I took the test. I was glad, I mean, that was a step. That was a step in my beginning to recognize that I was step one. I was unmanageable. I didn't have any control over it. And it's something I really didn't want to admit because, like I said earlier, I'm definitely a control kind of person. So one night I went to bed, and this was during that time when Clark was still in a lot of therapy. We were driving back and forth to Decatur and Shepherd Center and, you know, just back and forth and back and forth. He spent like all day there. So it's really like that had become my job. My job was to get up and get us out the door in his wheelchair and, you know, get us all out the door by 7, drive all the way to Decatur, which sometimes took an hour and 15 minutes. And his therapy started at 8:25, and then we were done about 2:45, and then sit in the loveliness that is 85 South to 75, you know, North. And so it was a full-time job, and during that time I continued to drink. So at one point, since my recovery, my husband, Ron, said to me that he would come home, and it wasn't even like I was belligerent or, I mean, I'm sure I was at sometimes, but mostly I was blank. I was not there. He would come home, and I'd be sitting on the couch just expressionless, just not even there. I was gone. I was totally gone. And I don't think I realized it, you know. So when I started searching and started looking for maybe I do have a problem, when I started realizing these kind of things, I went down one morning to the, I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. So that one night, Ron came in the door, I could see by the look on his face, he's like, great, she's drunk again, awesome, you know. And I remember feeling bad about that. Like it, and I didn't care before. I didn't care. And I did, suddenly I cared. I was like, this is, here I am again, you know, and it kind of bothered me. So I went to bed early, and I went to bed with the idea, I'm just going to go to bed and go to sleep. And I got to bed, and I could not sleep. Tossing. And in my head is, God, what are you waiting for, Mary Ellen? Waiting for a DUI? You waiting to crash your car and kill yourself? How's your son going to get to therapy? How's your husband going to keep working if your ass is in jail? What gives, chick? You know, it's time to give it up. And so laying there in bed, I did. I said, God, please help me. I can't do this anymore. I cannot do it anymore. It's too painful. It's too hard. But I was petrified of what it meant to give it up. I was petrified of not having my anesthetic. What am I going to do? How am I going to face this without it? So my sweet husband came to bed,
And I turned to him and said, I need help. And he's knowing full well what I meant. He made me say it. He said, what do you mean you need help? I said, I'm an alcoholic. And you know what I got when I said that? I got the biggest hug I've ever gotten in my life. He said, I'm so proud of you. We'll do this. We'll get through it together. So how big of a blessing is that, to have that kind of support? I love you, honey.
So I remember going down the next morning, and you know, we all like to Google stuff, right? So I Googled Christian woman alcoholic. So wondering what's going to pop up. Maybe a Christian woman alcoholic who told me I'm not alcoholic. Please, God. So up pops a link to this book called Sober Mercies. And I'm like, huh, that's interesting. And the subtitle is How Love Caught Up with a Christian Drunk. So I went to the Amazon website, and you know how you can read like two or three pages on the website. I was riveted. I was like, oh my God. I mean, I was like grabbing at the monitor trying to turn the next page. I was just riveted by the story. So I ordered the book. Book came. I went the next morning to my first AA meeting. And being the snobby East Cobb woman that I was like, well, I don't want to go like to a, you know, a one of those AA meetings. I'll go to East Cobb. Like, I'll go over in the ritzy part of Marietta to one of those meetings. So I went over to one of those meetings for a little while. And the problem was that meeting was at like at 8 o'clock at night. And I'm generally brain turning off usually around that time. So it worked for a little while. I drive over there. It took me 20, 30 minutes to get there, 20, 30 minutes to get home. So by the time I would come home, it would be like 9:30, 9:40. And I just kind of didn't really feel... I got sober there. I mean, I started to get sober there, but I didn't feel like I wanted to keep dragging all the way over to Johnson Ferry just for a meeting. So I kept seeing this How place. I'd look up in the little, you know, AA thing or online, How. I'm like, it says... I live off of Bells Ferry Road, right? I'm like 2 miles maybe down the road. Down the road. I'm terrible. Ron will tell you I'm terrible at directions. Is it really that way? Or that way? Okay, anyway. Somewhere. I live around here. I live around here for sure. So I'm like, where's How Place? I've never seen it. I've lived here for 26 years. Where's How Place? So finally I realized where it was. And I thought, well, I'm going to go give How Place a try. And I saw that there was a Monday night women's meeting. And so I went to the Monday night women's meeting and I saw a familiar face or two. And I stopped after the meeting and talked to my beautiful friend Amy that I had known before all this started and had no idea she was an alcoholic, because as you all know, she's just this wonderful, beautiful, sweet person. And we had known each other through church and school and everything for years and years and years, and more peripherally, but you know, we weren't like best buddies, but we were friends and acquaintances. And so I asked her, was it that first night? I think it was. I asked her if she would sponsor me, because I knew I needed a sponsor. That's something that everything I read said, get a sponsor. And I thought, well, gosh. And we talked about it, because I said, she's like, will it be weird because I know you? And I said, you know, I think it's the opposite. I think I'm glad you know me. I think it'll be good that you know me. And we have had she's been an amazing sponsor. She helped me through all the steps and even the dreaded fourth step. I really, really, really did not want to do the fourth step. But it ended up being such an integral part of my recovery. I mean, it was like getting down to things that, like the control part in childhood of wanting to be the good kid, I never really thought about that. And maybe that laid some groundwork for later control issues in my life. You know, I never saw that connection. And there's a whole bunch of other family crap I can go into, but I won't. I'll save you all that that pleasure. But I have found something. I found so many things in recovery. And the main thing was, when I came to How Place, it sounds corny, but I instantly felt at home here. Like, I just came to a Tuesday night meeting with Amy, and just, I never felt judged. I never felt, I felt like it was a place that I could really keep coming. A, it was really convenient, which was awesome. And B, I just felt, I look around the room and I would hear people's stories, and in the beginning, I'm not going to lie, in the beginning, I was trying to find some reasons that I wasn't an alcoholic. Well, I don't drink like her, or, you know, God, I've never been in jail, or, oh, I mean, I had all these things, these reasons that I wasn't. But truth was, the more I started to keep, you know, stay the course and do the steps and look at myself, I started looking for the similarities and not the differences. And that was really something I heard someone say. I heard someone say that in the rooms. Stop looking for the differences and start looking for the similarities. And once I started doing that, I found all the reasons that it really was. And it was, that sounds like a bummer, but as you all know, it was actually a huge step in my recovery, because I started to identify myself. I started to find myself again. And as I got better and better, I started to heal. And I started maybe seeing a glimmer of those promises everybody talked about, you know. And Amy and I always joke about in the part where it says how it works, and there's the part where it's, well, two things. I love the part in how it works where it says, those people who don't recover, those who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Doesn't say easy program. It's not easy, but it is simple. It's step by step. And if you can just take a step and keep going and take another step, I think that's the key. That's the kind of thing for me. I joke about being from Missouri because I'm a, you know, show me state. Show me. You got to show me how it works. But I truly am a visual learner. So it's like if people can give me these little nuggets of information I get in the rooms. Every time I come to a meeting, I get something different. Even ones that the most unusual share sometimes I will have, like, wow, that's me. I get that. I get what they're talking about. And I think sometimes we're afraid to share, or we feel like we shared and maybe someone hurt your feelings, or, you know, it can be a brutal process of bearing yourself. But at the same time, it's such a freeing process. And I've had, I was telling Damon when he was, before the meeting, I said, I've had shares where I've felt after I did them, I'm like, God, that was just a bunch of word vomit. It was nothing. And then someone will come and say, gosh, I really liked your share. And I'm like, really? But and Damon said he's had shares where people have come up and found some little sidebar he said, just something he just kind of put out there, didn't even really think about. And that's what really hit home with them. So that's the beauty of this program, is that you find yourself here. And I heard a guy, I wish I remembered his name. He's so awesome. He, back there in the Ebby room, he said, when you think about it, this is the one place you can come for a dollar, mind you. I mean, where can you go for a dollar anymore? Anywhere? I mean, I don't think so. You, for a dollar, you get understanding, compassion, true friendship, no judgment. I mean, how many places, this is the part that really hit home with me that he was talking about. He said, how many places do you go where someone doesn't want something from you? That's rare. I mean, even at church, there are people who are like, maybe if I go over and talk to her right now, she might be on that committee I've got to form. You know, I mean, it's like, and it's all good, but it's like, we all have ulterior motives. And in here, there really aren't any. And there's, the people in this room want you to get better. They truly do. One of the most miraculous things to me about the program. You get a phone call from somebody or a text from somebody who's in trouble, and you get to go. I get to go be a shoulder for that woman who's in pain. I get to go help somebody. I took on my first sponsee this year, just a few months ago, and it truly is a gift. I mean, it's not more work. Oh God, I got something else I got to do. It's not that way at all. And that's to me what tells you the spirituality of this program. If it's something that you're passionate about, and it gives you energy, that's not even work, right? The old expression, if you love your job, you never work a day in your life. And right now, one of my biggest jobs is volunteer work and a nonprofit organization that I run to get safety rails on those stupid high beds so no other family has to go through what my family went through. And it's like that kind of, I told someone, I said, you know, I don't get paid a dime to do volunteer work or my RAD work, my Rail Against the Danger work, but it fuels me. It's like it comes from a place so deep inside me, and it doesn't make me tired, it makes me energetic. It makes me want to go do it. And you walk out of a time of helping another drunk, a person who's really struggling, you walk out of that time, you're not tired. You're like, wow, I hope I did some good. I hope that I planted a seed. I hope that God gave me something to give that person. And He does that. I don't do that. I mean, I'm a vessel. I'm available for Him to flow through and help others. That's the way I look at myself. It's not like my words. It's the way to be there for somebody else in such a beautiful way. And again, it's a dollar. Money well spent. Let's see. I'm going to hit a couple little notes here. Oh, okay. This is one of my favorite things. And I tend to be a little bit AA. What is it? ADHD?
Or,
which is the one you're all over the place and you don't, you can't, ADHD? Okay, I have that. One of the things that has helped me to stay sober is this concept that really hit home to me in the book, big book, about the allergy and the obsession. Once, I think that's what I didn't grasp when I relapsed one time so far, hopefully never again, but I was almost 7 months sober. And I really thought I had this thing. I got this. I think I can have just a little bit of wine. Husband's going out of town. Put it in a pretty glass. Drink all by myself, like the old days. It'll be awesome, right? No. So that part of my recovery is part of my recovery. You'll hear people say in the rooms, relapse is not a part of recovery. I would prefer to say relapse doesn't have to be part of recovery. It's part of my story. It's part of my story that I'm actually really grateful for, because that relapse taught me, yep, you're an alcoholic. And the control freak inside of me that wants to check every box, and you notice that I literally checked the boxes as I was doing that test, right? I can't help it. So, but I think that's what God did for me in that relapse, was He showed to me very clearly, Mary Ellen, you're not going to check this one, honey. This is not a box you can check and move on. You are an alcoholic. And spoiler alert, you'll be one the rest of your life. Yay! But you know what? But I don't... It was freeing, though. Instead of being like, bummer, I'm an alcoholic, it was like, okay, I can't check the box. So I'll just check the box that says I can't check the box. Score! But working the steps the second time is what really changed everything. That slip up, that relapse, even though it was only 12 hours long, I came in the next morning, Jim and Rob, a bunch of the guys were here, and I picked up a white chip and started over. And I think that's why to this day, the white chip for me is, God, I love when people get white chips. You know, because, you know, they come dragging up like, and I'm over there going, whoop, whoop, white chip, because I think it's that powerful. It's saying, I give up. I give up. I don't want to do this shit anymore. I'm not going to do this anymore. I don't want to live this way. And to me, that's not weakness. That's strength. That's grabbing it, saying, I want something better. Because not only do we want something better for ourselves, our higher power wants something better for us. He doesn't want this for us. This is not part of His plan. Might be part of somebody else's plan, but it's not part of His plan. So, it's so beautiful. I was talking about step work, and that's one thing I was a little bit kind of maybe apprehensive about at first. Like, what do I have to offer somebody else? Or what if I do it wrong? Or what if I sponsor somebody wrong? And I even called Amy and said, how do I sponsor somebody? I'm a little bit freaked out. And she's like, Mary Ellen, you're making a big surprise, making it harder than it is. She said, just share your journey. Share what you did. It's all you can do. Like Damon said, I can't share anybody. I can't tell anybody else how to feel. I can't give you my opinion on what you should do, because you've got to do it. All I can do is say, hey, this worked for me. You might want to try it. Try the steps. Try getting a sponsor. Try coming in here and coming back to meetings that actually, you know, that actually might work. So last night I had an opportunity to do some step work, some sponsor work rather. What do you call it? Just being there with somebody, you know, sharing and helping. kind of a 911 situation. And so I didn't have a chance to read my Each Day a New Beginning. I love this book. It's a women's devotional for daily meditation. And I didn't get a chance to read my meditation, so I read it last night. And this is just so funny how God works. This is after I have just spent a couple amazing hours with a woman who was really struggling. It says at the top, "What a strange pattern the shuttle of life can weave. Each experience we have plays its part in the total picture of our lives. The steps we have taken, the path we travel today, and our direction tomorrow are not by chance. There's a pattern. We each have a destiny. We may have veered off the path in the past, and we may veer off it again, but we'll be guided back, and our paths intersect. None of this is traveling alone. We have each other and the creative force that is at the helm. When we look around us and reflect on how our lives are influenced by the persons close to us, we become aware that our presence affects their lives as well. Most of us could never have predicted the events that have influenced us, nor can we anticipate what the future may hold. We can be certain, however, that we are safe. A power greater than ourselves is orchestrating our affairs. There were times we feared we'd never survive this experience. Perhaps we still struggle with fears and new experiences, but every experience adds a necessary thread to the pattern of life we are weaving. We have the gift of reflection. We can understand today the importance of particular events of the past. Next month, next year, we'll understand today." And at the bottom it says, "I shall enjoy the richness of today. My life is weaving an intricate, necessary pattern that is uniquely mine." And only God can do that. I read that last night and I was like, that is perfect. That is exactly how I felt. It's exactly what I needed to share today. And another lovely lady I met last night sent me this morning. She couldn't come. And she sent me this beautiful sunrise over a cornfield kind of picture. And it says, "The meaning of life is to find your gift. The purpose of life is to give it away." Thanks for letting me share.